Welcome to Carry the Fire, a podcast where we explore the big questions of life through the lens of the good, the true, and the beautiful. I'm your host, Dustin Kensrue, and my hope is that through these conversations with people of diverse and divergent backgrounds and beliefs, we can glimpse the world anew through each other's unique perspectives.
That whole issue around heresy and orthodoxy was a sort of a main point for the church's energy, fighting off heresy and trying to establish orthodoxy. And I suppose it continued then with the breakup of Christianity into all the various factions. All these factions mainly emphasized their difference from each other through what they believed. Mm-hmm. Now, if you take that and compare it to the Celtic monks during that early period of Celtic Christianity in Ireland, there's no evidence that there were any disputes among the monks themselves as to orthodoxy, as to who was believing the right thing and who was teaching the wrong thing. Mm. There's no evidence of any controversy in the Irish church.
Hey, everybody. Today we are joined by Dara Molloy. Dara is a Celtic priest, a writer, and a guide for pilgrims on the Aran Islands where he lives off the coast of Ireland. In our conversation, we talk about some of the negative consequences of institutions and globalization. Dara shares what sets apart the Celtic tradition from the Roman Catholic one he was a part of previously, and he shares about the importance of experience in his own life. Let's dive in. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show.
You're very welcome. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, I like to start off asking everyone on the show, when you were growing up, what would cause you to feel a deep sense of wonder about the world?
Well, I grew up in North Dublin, and my mom and dad had built a new house out well past the suburbs, past the Greenbelt around Dublin City, which was a small city at the time. Just outside a little village called Malahide, which had about 1,000 residents. Mm-hmm. So even there, we were outside the village, about a mile's walk to the village. And I can remember outside my back garden, seeing two horses plow the field. That'll tell you how old I am, that I can remember horses plowing fields. And my dad used to regularly take us as young children for walks. And what I remember about those is that he didn't like to stay on the road. He liked to open the gate into a field and walk through the fields and find gaps in the hedges to walk from one field into the next. And I think he must have stirred up my imagination to think about what could be living in the fields. Would we see a fox? Would we see a badger? You know, all this wildlife that was out here. Mm. And that's my first real abiding experience of wonder, being out in nature and just being mesmerized by all the possibility of life and the variety of life that could appear at any moment around me. And I've never quite managed to get that feeling again as an adult. Mm. But it's like something I've been reaching for all my life. I remain very interested in being out and about in nature. I live on a small island in the Atlantic Ocean where I'm immersed in nature, and that's one of the reasons I came to live here. And I do a lot of bird watching and nature watching. I have a telescope and binoculars, and almost every day I walk down to the lake to see what's happening down there because it can change every day. So that's an abiding sense of wonder for me, and I think I got it with my father when I was a tiny child.
Hmm. That's great. I wanted to talk a bit about Celtic Christianity, and one of the patrons of the show, she was interested in the reasons that you ended up leaving the Roman Catholic Church, which you were a priest in for some time, and she said she'd like to hear what some of your feelings were around this decision and how you felt after it was vocalized and became a reality.
That's a long story, but I give you a shortened version of it. Okay. Yeah. I think when I was about 12 years of age, I can remember lying in bed at night and wondering what's life all about and what should I do with my life. And I remember that the key question for me was, does God exist or does he not? and it was a he at that time, mm-hmm. For me. I was reared in a very Roman Catholic family. My dad went to Mass every day, and the whole family went to Mass every Sunday. And so it was a very central part. I would say my dad particularly was a conservative Catholic, not just a Catholic, although he was liberal in the area of justice and politics and things like that. But anyway, that's what I grew up with. And at the age of 12, I made this decision that I was going to believe in God, and therefore that my life would be dedicated to this God. Mm. That was the way it worked for me in my head, that once there's a God there, that's the most important thing, and I must dedicate my life to the service of that God. I'm not sure how I put it when I was age 12, but it was something like that. Mm-hmm. So I went on then all through my schooling with the intention of becoming a priest. Left school, worked for a year because I felt I needed to mature a bit and experience the world. And then I entered a seminary, which at the time was a very enclosed space. Like, you really cut yourself off from the world when you did that. You cut yourself off from your friends. You wrote home once or twice a month. You didn't go home even for Christmas. This is my first year. Hmm. And so it was very, very enclosed, almost like a cult, I would say now. But gradually, over the course of training to be a priest, it opened up because the Vatican Council was happening and had happened, and everything changed from being a very tight-knit, cultish type seminary to being very open, and we all became sort of, we went around, instead of wearing soutanes and Roman collars, we went around wearing jeans and t-shirts by the end of my training, which was 9 years later. So it was a huge transformation, and we went from doing all our studies in Latin to doing them in English. But gradually, I think over time, I began to see that there were certain aspects of the church which I liked, and other aspects which I didn't like. And I think it took a long time in my adulthood to get clear about that. I suppose looking back now, it's very clear to me that what I didn't like was the institutional side of the church. I most certainly didn't like the hierarchy and this idea that commands came from on top. I remember when I made my vows, which was one of the requirements of becoming a priest. You made three vows, the vow of poverty, chastity and obedience. And I went to my boss before making them and I said, can I rewrite those vows? No, can I put my own words in it? And he nearly blew a fit. Like, he said, absolutely no way, you can't do that. So I remember in my own mind saying, well, if you won't let me change the words, these words are going to mean what I want them to mean. So that's actually how I made my vows, with that in mind. Because the vow of obedience, for example, was to be obedient to your superior general, who is the head person of the religious order, which I was connected with, and he lived in Rome. And I was more or less vowing to be obedient to him. Whereas in my own mind, the person I wanted to be obedient to at the time was God. And that could put me in conflict, I felt, with human authorities at times. And it later turned out indeed to be the case, because if you like, from their perspective, I became very disobedient. So I had this sense of being on my own personal journey, and the church to a certain extent facilitating that. But gradually, as time went on, it actually got in the way of it. And what got in the way of was, I wanted to allow my life to be led from inside, if you like. Mm. Whereas by joining this institution, the framework for how I live my life was imposed upon me. It was like I was given a box to live in, and this is the way I was meant to live. The box even included how I was to dress, how people were to address me, where I would live. All of that was outside of my control. And that's the bit I didn't like. So it got to a stage where I hit a crisis point, because I didn't know how else to live a spiritual life in a sort of dedicated, wholehearted, 100% fashion without being a priest. If I was to leave the priesthood and the religious order, what would I do? Would I just go off and, like my friends who had, many of whom had left the priesthood, would I just go off and become a counsellor or a social worker or a youth worker or a community development officer. This is what many of my other friends had done. And I felt, I don't want to do that. I want to actually be a priest. I just don't want to be a priest this way. I don't want to be an institutional priest. I want to be somebody who's of service to others in a spiritual sense. So I don't know how well I put it then. Like, in a way, the words you hear now are the words I'm putting on it now, you know. So,
yeah.
But anyway, that crisis was resolved when I discovered the Aran Islands. Just by chance, I brought a group of young people. I was working with young people at the time, brought them on a camping holiday to the Aran Islands. And when I got here, I discovered the old monastic ruins of monks who had lived here from the 6th century onwards. Mm-hmm. And it struck me that the life that they had and the lifestyle that they had was the sort of lifestyle that would suit me very well. I'd live out in the open air. I would be very much immersed in nature. I would also be very immersed in my own cultural heritage, because these islands still speak the Gaelic language, which mm-hmm. very few other places in the country do. And these islands also, through their resident population, have kept a lot of the ancient traditions, which would have been lost on the mainland. So there are lots of reasons why this place seemed very attractive to me. And I felt that if I came here to live, I could sort of try to imitate the lifestyle of some of these early monks. So that gave me the out. Now, it wasn't very easy to extract myself from the institutional way of life and still remain a member of it, because I still did remain a member of it. For the next 10 years, I was sort of on the edge, if you like. I was on the very edge of the institutional church, but I hadn't stepped over the line. I was still inside. And at a certain point, 10 years after I came to live on the Aran Islands, that line was crossed and I stepped over it, and I declared that I was going to remain a priest but not belong to any institutional church of any kind. That was the most frightening moment of my life, because I then discovered what I now write about quite a bit, is the power of myth to control people's lives and ways of seeing life. Like my mother, for example, when I told her I was leaving the church, she said she had a huge crisis, almost a bigger crisis than I had.
Mm.
Because for her, the hotline to God was gone. I was her hotline to God.
Mm.
And now I wasn't going to be available for her in the same way anymore. Now, strangely, you know, whatever, 25, 30 years later, she's still alive. She's just over 100 years of age.
Oh, wow.
And now she understands completely my position. In fact, after the funeral of my last aunt, which was her sister, I did a service to commemorate the life of my aunt with the family and so on. And my mother phoned me the next day and said, "Will you do that for me when I die too, please?"
Oh.
So she's come around completely without leaving the Catholic Church herself, or saying she still says her prayers and so on. But she now understands where I'm at. And of course, a lot of scandal has happened in the church since I left. And the Irish people, who used to be about 95% church going when I was growing up, have now reduced in some parts of the country to maybe about 10% church going.
Oh, so wow.
There's been a huge falling away from the church, mainly due to the scandals and to the no longer any sense of respect for the authority of the church. So things are very different now than they used to be.
Hmm.
And there's a whole new group of people now growing up in Ireland who I think would call themselves spiritual but not religious. And they're the people that I cater for. I do their weddings, their vow renewals, their christenings or naming ceremonies for the children, and their funerals.
Hmm.
I do all of that.
So you are a priest, but not part of an organization now. Are there other Celtic priests who are doing similar things to you, or are you just totally on your own?
I'm totally on my own. There are quite a number of women in Ireland whom I would say are doing parallel type work to me. Most of them, however, have one leg inside the church and would work alongside a parish community and a parish clergy And another leg of them would be outside of it, like doing yoga or meditation or some of these other activities, which wouldn't be mainstream Catholic Church anymore. Mm-hmm. A lot of women in that category, but I wouldn't think that any of them would call themselves a Celtic priest or a monk, that I call myself that. But that's only my own title. I give it to myself. Nobody gives it to me.
And so what are you drawing from then as, like, are there old texts that you are kind of picking up to, like, because you also are, I think, drawing from pre-Christian Irish traditions as well, yeah?
Yes. Yeah, thankfully in Ireland we have a spiritual tradition that goes back probably to when the first people landed in Ireland, which was after the Ice Age, about 10,000 years ago. And since then, we have a lot of myths and legends. We have sacred places marked on the landscape. You know, we have the most wonderful place called Newgrange outside Dublin, which was built earlier than the pyramids in Egypt.
Oh, wow.
And which is a huge mound. You can walk through a narrow tunnel and get inside it. Inside it is a huge big room, or really three rooms. And on the 21st of December every year, if the sun is shining and not blocked by the clouds, as it rises on that morning of the darkest day of the year, the light of the sun comes through the light box above the door of the of this mound, and lights travels down the tunnel, if you like, and into this big room and lights up the room. So on just a few days of the year only, the inner chamber of this huge mound gets lit up from outside by the sun. Like, it's extraordinary. So we have a lot of places like that, but that's obviously the creme de la creme. Standing stones, stone circles, a lot of myths about ancient gods and goddesses and stories about them. And interestingly, they've still been kept in the Irish imagination. We still talk about them and use them quite a bit. There's place names with their names in the place name. And there's lots of other ways in which they're remembered. For example, the month of August in the Gaelic language is the month of Lunasa. And that's the month of the god Lu. And the god Lu was the god of the harvest. So that's why August is called Lunasa. It's the harvest month. Mm. And people are celebrating the victory of this god Lu in bringing about the harvest for us. So we have this sort of thread that, if you start pulling it and tracing it back, can bring you thousands of years back through our heritage and our history. But the thread also goes through the Christian period. Like, if you take the Roman Catholic period, obviously they tried to suppress it. But if you go back far enough, say to the 12th century and further back, it becomes pre-Roman and it becomes Celtic Christianity. And a lot of the Celtic Christian monks kept these traditions or maintained them. In fact, the only source we have for the written down version of these myths and legends is from these monks, who recorded the stories in writing, because there was no reading and writing before the monks. So they actually recorded these stories for us, and did so not from the point of view of condemning them, but rather of maintaining them. So, like, I've tried to reimagine what these Christian monks actually believed and practiced, because in a way they were trying to keep their old traditions and also incorporate Christianity into them. So it's like Christianity was just another layer on top of what they had already inherited. Because if you look at the history of Christianity in Ireland, it wasn't brought to Ireland like the way it was brought to many another country, you know, part of an invading force. Mm-hmm. That therefore imposed Christianity on the locals and forced them to get rid of their own indigenous spiritualities. That wasn't the way it happened in Ireland. The Christianity that came into Ireland from the 5th century onwards was brought in by Irish people who travelled out to Europe, picked up a version of Christianity that appealed to them, and brought it back. And I think the version that appealed to them was what they found in rural society in Europe, because there were no cities in Ireland at the time. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Europe, the Christianity that we think of today actually was focused in cities and towns. Yeah. Like, St. Paul wrote to various cities and St. Peter travelled to Rome. It was with Rome and Jerusalem and Corinth and places like that, which is where Christianity thrived in Europe. But the Irish people who brought it back to Ireland weren't interested in that style of Christianity because they didn't have any cities. So they were interested in a rural type of Christianity, which they found in particularly the monastery of St. Martin of Tours. He, more than anybody, I think, inspired the Irish tradition. So that's a whole different expression of Christianity than we find in mainstream Europe at the time. And that conflict between then what developed in Ireland as what I call Celtic Christianity and what was developing in Europe were sort of polar opposite versions of Christianity. And the only reason Celtic Christianity survived for so long was because we were so far away from the centre. And also the Roman Empire, which Christianity became very associated with, never reached Ireland. So they couldn't get at us that way either. So Celtic Christianity survived, not in a pure form, but it did survive right through to the 12th century. And it was only when we were invaded by the Normans that the Roman version of Christianity came in. That was in the 12th century. So before that, we had a very different version of Christianity. And that's where I've really spent this part of my life since I came to live on the island here. That's what I've spent really studying and practicing and trying to rediscover, because it's buried underneath a whole lot of history that's been written by Roman, pro-Roman writers and historians rather than pro-Celtic, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, what would be the easiest way to contrast what you have found and value in the Celtic tradition versus the Roman?
I'll give you just two examples. I think there's a lot more. One example would be the Christian monks inherited from their pagan ancestors a sense of the sacred in nature, so a sense of presence in everything around them in nature. Your first question to me was, when did I first experience the sense of wonder? And that's exactly what I think that our tradition has revealed for us, is that you can have a sense of wonder in all different aspects of nature, and that when you feel that sense of wonder, that's the divine. That's the what they call the other world as well. They had lots of different words for it. So that'd be one thing. And then the way I look at it is that when they sensed a presence in some aspect of nature, they then over time personified that presence into a personality. And it became a god or a goddess. So we have a number of gods that are connected with the sea, others that are connected with their goddesses, connected with rivers, goddesses connected with the land, with the sun, with the different seasons, with the weather, with various trees, and so on. So, you know, that's, for me, that's a tool that we can use today to get back into reconnecting with nature and getting a sense of the wonder and mystery of nature and life other than ourselves all around us. So that certainly comes from the Celtic tradition. And I would say the other thing perhaps is more applied to the Christian element of the tradition. If you look at the history of the Celtic monks, at a time when Celtic monasticism in Ireland was flourishing, you know, we had a golden age in Ireland. We talk about it in our history books. It was about the 7th and 8th century. It was a time when there was a monastery almost within 5 miles of each other all over the country. Every part of the country had its own monastery, a monastic community, and those communities were places where all sorts of creativity and artistic expression and scholarship and spirituality thrived. That's where we get books being produced like the famous Book of Kells, or where we get some of the wonderful works of metalwork like the Arda Chalice. I mean, we have all these things now in our museum that represent that period. So it was a golden age. And that's exactly the time when Europe was going through its dark ages. It had fallen apart after the collapse of the Roman Empire. But also in Europe, in the Church of Europe had focused on orthodoxy, focused on the list of beliefs that you were required to have in order to be a member of the church. So that was like from the 4th century onwards, they were teaching the Nicene Creed. And even up to this day in Catholic churches, you recite the Creed as part of the Mass every Sunday. So you recite a list of the things that you are purported to believe as a Roman Catholic. And of course, the idea was that if you didn't believe in them, or if you believed something different, you became a heretic and you were condemned. And there was a long, long period in church history in Europe where that whole issue around heresy and orthodoxy was a sort of a main point for the church's energy, fighting off heresy and trying to establish orthodoxy. And I suppose it continued then with the breakup of Christianity into all the various factions. All these factions mainly emphasized their difference from each other through what they believed. Mm-hmm. Now, if you take that and compare it to the Celtic monks during that early period of Celtic Christianity in Ireland, there's no evidence that there were any disputes among the monks themselves as to orthodoxy, as to who was believing the right thing and who was teaching the wrong thing. Mm. There's no evidence of any controversy in the Irish church. They were accused of heretics as soon as they went out to Europe, mind you. Mm-hmm. But in Ireland among themselves, there's no evidence that they ever fell out over believing one thing as against another. And that's, according to my reckoning, that's because their interest was not in what you believed at all. It was their interest was in how you lived your life and how you could perfect your life in such a way that you could experience the divine all the time. It's like immerse yourself in the presence of the divine at every moment of every day. That's really, I think, what they were trying to achieve, and find the lifestyle and perfect their own way of living in that lifestyle to achieve that. So it was sort of a heroic journey they were on, and it was a personal mission they were on. They weren't out to convert other people. They were out to convert themselves. And by doing so, they knew that they would then influence other people. So it was sort of a completely different approach to mission than the mainstream church in Europe at the time. So lots of differences, really, in the Celtic version of church. I call these Celtic monks mystics. And I define a mystic as someone who's more interested in the mystery and experience the mystery of life than in finding answers to that mystery, or in insisting that these are the answers and not the other things that other people are saying. So these monks were mystics in my view, and they weren't at all interested in right or wrong answers. They just wanted to live the mystery.
Talk a bit about your book, which I think is touching on a lot of this, but it's called The Globalization of God, The Nemesis of Celtic Christianity. What was the impetus behind writing that book? Why did you feel you had to do that, and what's your main point you're trying to get across?
Well, this book is probably about 7 years' work of writing and rewriting and rewriting. I began by writing a book trying to illustrate what Celtic Christianity looked like. Mm-hmm. And the more I tried to write that, the more I had to explain how it was different from Roman Christianity. And the more I did that, the more I realized that there was a whole historic process that went on that alienated Celtic Christianity. Only in the last year did it get the title that it has today, because it was only then I could see the whole picture. And in the course of it, I think I learned a huge amount which I didn't know before I started writing. The Roman Church began to establish itself on the lines of the Roman Empire and began to develop a mission for itself of going right around the whole world. So sort of a global mission. And looking back now, I can see that the globalization that we still experience today, and it comes through secular corporations now, that actually began with Christianity, and especially with Roman Christianity. Mm-hmm. They had the global vision first. They sort of packaged their beliefs into what you could call today products, which they could then disseminate around the world, get people to believe them. And then they also created the institutional structures to make it happen. So, for example, they established Latin as the standard language of the church, no matter where you went in the world. That's a good example of what I'm talking about. So, if you like, the world got the template for globalization of products and services from the Roman Church. And in the course of that development and pushing out its objectives, it therefore had to either get rid of any alternative expression of Christianity or amalgamate it or suppress it. And it managed to do that within mainland Europe by suppressing heresies over time. But because the Celtic Church was out on the fringe, it found it very difficult to suppress it. It didn't have political power within Ireland in particular, and there are other Celtic regions besides Ireland. So Ireland was the last bastion of the Celtic Church because we in particular had remained sovereign and free as a nation. And so the church had no political way to get in among us. They could only use their persuasion, which they did. And that did cause a certain blend of both Roman and Celtic Christianity to develop in Ireland over time. Mm. But it wasn't eventually until the Roman church came in with the Norman invasion in the 12th century that eventually everything Celtic, if you like, collapsed. So that's really what this book is saying. It's saying it's a story, it's a historical story of the Roman church developing as a global organization and what the effects of that are on all indigenous traditions, mm-hmm. spiritual and cultural. And I just use the Celtic spiritual tradition as an example,
yeah.
because that's the one I know best.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about how much thought you've put into the way that focus in the book would apply to other indigenous traditions, beliefs. What I'm curious about is if you have thoughts on like a way out of the situations we find ourselves in the modern world with globalization and the problems that brings, especially as it relates to corporations and large institutions. I know you live out, is it the Aran Islands? Is that how you pronounce it?
Aran Islands, Aran, yeah. Yeah, the west coast of Ireland on the Atlantic Ocean, about 10 miles from the mainland.
Mm-hmm. So you have this small community there, and there's a lot of ways that you can live in a very local focused kind of way there. And I do want to hear about that, but do you feel like everyone should be trying to localize in a sense? And what does that look like to you?
Yeah, I suppose I do. Yeah. I mean, since globalization became a sort of a common word in our vocabulary, I think we've, in the Western world, we've seen that there has to be a balance between the globalizing forces that come into our society and then the local expressions, which make us diverse and different. And that's a constant struggle to try and balance the two. The world has got far too imbalanced in favor of globalization.
Mm-hmm.
And I blame monotheism for that. So not just Christianity or not just the Catholic Church, but monotheism in all its forms. So that would include Islam and Judaism and a few other religions. Because monotheism is this belief, if you like, that there's only one way to see the world, and that's from the perspective of this God we believe in. And by the way, all of these monotheist religions, just to my knowledge, all descend from the version of monotheism that was started by Moses and Abraham. We all come from the same root. So it's this sense of our Father who art in heaven, that's the ultimate perspective on our world and on our lives. And it's not on this earth at all. It's outside it, and it's a global vision. And I think as long as there are enough of us on this earth who believe that and subscribe to that vision, we're going to have a lopsided world. I think there's room for looking at the world from a global perspective. But I think it has to be balanced with looking at the world from many other perspectives. And a metaphor I use for that is the eye of a fly. Mm-hmm. People, I think, know that the eye of a fly is made up of lots of tiny little eyes. Mm-hmm. Apparently, in a normal fly in your house, the fly would have about 4,000 of these small eyes. But actually, in a dragonfly, there's something like 25,000. It's quite extraordinary. Mm. But each of these little eyes picks up something of what's going on out there. But it's only the brain of the dragonfly that puts all those little images together and creates the whole picture. And that, to me, is a metaphor for how I'd like to see our world be. That it's quite true that each one of us is unique and different. We all have our own perspective on life. Therefore, we can all experience things differently, and we can all see things differently. So in a way, we're each like one of those tiny little eyes of the dragonfly. And when a group of us get together and think that because there's a large enough group of us that we have all the answers, that's when you get fundamentalism and the arrogance of some of the churches, and you lose the overall perspective. So, and I think the only way we get the overall, even the sense, I'm not saying even there's an answer in this, but the best way to go about it is to listen to everybody and to respect everybody.
It's interesting framing it from the angle of monotheism. I feel like it has somehow more to do with the way that's normally held or enacted than the idea of a unified reality in some sense. I think it's going back to that mystic idea. I feel like the belief in some sort of ultimate being, whatever you're going to frame that as, is not necessarily the problem, but it's when the abstraction of whatever you believe that is becomes this false concrete in your life, where you think that you have it figured out. Not only is there this one perspective, but I actually understand it perfectly, and now I need you to as well.
So we've all got this sense of there being a greater being in the world, and we think we know its name, and we call it God. And I think already we've stepped over the line, because I know your name is Dustin and you know my name is Dara, because we've told each other, we've introduced ourselves to each other. I can see your face on the video and you can see mine. I have a sense who you are, and I have a feeling that I know you a little bit. Can we say the same about something that's so far beyond us, that's so much greater than us, that's so mysterious? Can we give it a name at all? Like, did it come and tell us its name? Is that where we got the name God? I don't think so. And do we know anything about it? How can we say our Father? How do we know it's a gender? So there are my questions. Like, once we step over that line and start talking as if we know, I can't even find a word for what it is, because I don't know what it is. Once you say this person, you've already defined it. Maybe it's not a person. So that's where I'm at. I'm sort of backing away from all this certainty that I had as a kid. And how far back do I have to go to be on steady ground? I feel I've got to go right back to where it becomes real for me. And where it becomes real for me is in the experiences that I have. So if I walk out into that field as a child and I experience wonder, the possibility of seeing a fox, that's a real experience for me. I know what that feeling is like, and I can still remember it today, so many years later. So there's the reality. What I do with that experience and how I interpret it is completely up to me. I can say, that sense of wonder is because I'm sensing the presence of God in the field. I can say that if I want to, but somebody else could say, no, not at all. That's not what it's about at all. It's something completely different. In other words, the experience is real and certain for me. How I interpret that experience is completely up to me. And the best example of that in terms of our monotheism now is how the Bible presents Moses and his experience in the desert, you know, the burning bush.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that story is told in the Bible, and it may or may not be fictitious, who knows. But the way the story is told is that Moses seemed to have had a very powerful personal experience in the desert, where he had a sense that a bush was burning and that a voice was speaking to him. I can relate to some of that. You know, I'd have had experiences similar to that, not quite the same, but similar, parallel. So that bit for me is the real bit, the experience that he may have had, which I can relate to. The unreal bit, the imagined bit, and the created bit is the narrative that now has been composed around that experience, which is to say, it was God speaking to him. It wasn't any of the gods he knew from his Egyptian background, like there are thousands of Egyptian gods. It wasn't any of them. It was the God of Abraham. And so on. That interpretation then is woven into a story where that particular God calls all the people out of Egypt, and Moses is the person that's meant to lead them out, and he gives them the Ten Commandments, and that God then becomes the central authority for a whole community of people, and goes on from there to what it is today. So what I'd be saying today is, let's go right back to the experience of Moses, or the experience of Jesus, or Muhammad, or Buddha, or anybody else you choose. All of the religions began with somebody experiencing something, and that's the real bit. And then something is created out of that experience, which then others subscribe to. Whereas I'd be saying, don't bother subscribing to those things unless the story that they tell you resonates with you. What's important is how you experience the story, not the story itself. So the best way for me to be a follower of Jesus is for me to find ways to experience the truth or the insights that he experienced, rather than simply to say, Jesus said it, therefore I'm going to believe it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I definitely know what you mean. I feel like, again, that's tying back to those that Celtic approach that you were talking about of,
yeah,
it was their focus was not on orthodoxy, but on and not even really on orthopraxy. Like it's less rigid than that.
Yeah,
because it seems like the their understanding of what was, you know, right practice and right living was very connected to their experience of themselves, their experience of their environment. And I think that's really healthy. It's definitely something that I had to learn, because I was very much told in my upbringing in evangelical Christianity to not trust my experience, my intuitions. And I think the harm that ends up doing is very hard to untangle, I think. And it's
extremely hard.
I think its roots go into so many different places. I doubt that there's any part of you that's not touched by that when you are actively conditioned to separate your own. I mean, even think about it in the way that we view authority in other places as well. Like you're being trained to not take your own thoughts seriously, not take your own convictions. And I imagine that especially like imagining all the harm that's done in the name of, or not the name of, but through patriarchal systems, especially to women who are brought up and told, don't trust yourself, and then are taken advantage of by so many people.
Yeah, I can see it at the moment in my life with my youngest daughter, who is still at school. And I can see how the institutional framework of schooling in Ireland, and it's probably similar in the States and other parts of the world, where her particularity and her particular interests and her particular giftedness or sources of energy and within herself, none of those are respected. And she is treated in the school like the way you treat maybe a herd of sheep. And it's interesting how, you know, in Ireland, the authorities, the politicians and so on, they talk about our education system as being one of the best in Europe. And if you ask why, one of the things they'll say is because all our students are treated fairly and equally. And that's expressed in a number of ways. One, it's expressed by the children all being forced to wear a uniform. And secondly, by them all having to sit the same exam when they get to the age of about 18, a state exam which everybody has to sit. And the thinking behind that really is that if we treat them all the same, we're treating them all fairly. Which, of course, is not the case at all. Because those who are most suited to the system will do best within the system. And those who are not suited to the system, and there are many, will feel that they are weak, unintelligent, their confidence will be damaged. Whereas those who succeed, they will develop big egos and, you know, think that they're the best gift to humanity. You know, it's all very distorted. Whereas if you go back to our own Celtic tradition, one of the big emphases in the spiritual teaching and the spiritual practice at that time was your own personal destiny. So everybody was regarded as having a personal destiny that nobody else could tell what it might be. Mm-hmm. So you were encouraged to have a soul friend, which was an anam cara. So that'd be somebody who could see through you and into your deepest parts. And hopefully the friendship was mutual. You could see into each other. That's, I suppose, the ideal. So that you could be helped, I suppose, to see yourself. You have somebody to reflect you back to yourself, somebody who loved you, whose acceptance of you was unconditional, and who understood you at a deep level. So there's that in the tradition. And then there's also in the tradition this idea of wandering, which actually began in the pagan history of Ireland as a sort of a practice, but certainly was developed and adapted into the Christian tradition as well, where every young monk, man or woman, was encouraged to not settle down at the earlier part of their lives, but to go off and experience new things and do something strange and different. And that's what led to so many Irish monks go out into Europe. They were leaving Ireland, which was prospering, peaceful, where they would have had a certain status within their community, because we had a class structure in Ireland at the time. A lot of these monks came from the upper classes, so they'd have had a high status within community. By leaving that all behind and going to Europe, they left all that. And Europe at the time was, as I said, in the Dark Ages when they were heading out there. So they were heading into chaos. A lot of there was a lot of illiteracy. Sometimes even the leaders, the kings and the queens, were illiterate. And so one of the jobs of these Celtic monks was often to actually teach literacy to the political leaders of the time. So, like, they were going out to sort of test their mettle. Mm-hmm. They weren't going out to be missionaries. They were going out to perfect who they really were as people and to discover who they really were as people. And lots of the stories about these monks illustrate that. Now, if you like, they found themselves by travelling into these strange places and strange situations. So that's part of it. And again, that's, to get back to what I was saying, is that's respect within the tradition for everybody's personal journey and everybody's personal destiny, and how the rest of us can't possibly know what your destiny is. Even if I'm my daughter's parent, I can't know what my daughter's destiny is. I can't dictate to her beyond teaching her certain moral values and principles. I can't dictate to her how she should live her life or what she should do or the choices that she should make.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all part of our tradition as well. And I suppose it's one of the reasons why I'm so wary of the major institutions that control our society and our lives these days, because these are sort of unconscious forces acting behind the scenes. And it's why maybe this COVID lockdown, which we're all experiencing throughout the world, will actually release a lot of people from these binds that they're in and give them the opportunity to take a whole new approach to their life, which I would see as a very healthy thing if they manage to do it.
Yeah, I've definitely, especially for me, like being a touring musician, it's, you know, having to figure out new ways of functioning. But there's a lot of health that's coming from being immobile when I'm usually always on the go.
Yeah.
So. Hey, everyone. If you're already supporting the show through Patreon, thank you so very much. If you aren't yet, I wanted to let you know that you can now become a patron and support the show for as little as $5 a month. Becoming a patron can provide you with a variety of perks, including access to additional content like song lyric breakdown episodes, Q&A episodes where you can submit questions for me to answer, additional conversation episodes that won't show up in the public feed, and access to our Discord board where we're building community and engaging in deeper conversations around the show. Here's a sneak peek at some additional patron-only content.
If we want to like anthropomorphize God at all, I would like to think that God also has those sort of same questions about God's self. That God is wondering who God is like. That there is some sense of an unrevealed nature, an unrevealed self to God's self. And I think that's really important for us to think about that, you know, not only do I think that God hasn't fully revealed God's self, fully revealed in some moment in time, fully revealed God's self to all of humanity and to all of the world. I don't even know that God has been fully revealed to God's self, to God. So, which I think gives us permission as humans, as finite beings, to not have all the answers too. Because if we haven't even been revealed, if God is not even revealed to God's own self fully, then maybe we should be given some grace that we don't have the answers for the full revelation of God, and that we can't absolutely say certainly what God is like. I think that gives us a lot of grace.
If you're digging this podcast and want to join me and others like you in our pursuit of the good, the true, and the beautiful, then joining us on Patreon is the best way to do it. Sign up today at patreon.com/carrythefirepod. All right, let's get back to the show. Yeah, that's interesting that you said the unconscious ways that these institutions function. I think that's a good way to describe it. It almost feels like they operate like organisms in a certain sense. Like there's a way once an organization gets large enough, it starts to do things. Like unless you're actively fighting that, I guess, but it starts to do the thing that an organization is going to do, and it naturally gravitates towards these hierarchies, towards these orthodoxies, as a way to grow and serve itself. But it's strange that those things seem somehow built into what it means to have an organization.
Yeah, I think that's probably a challenge for our generation, is to examine and critique our organizations, the very large ones that control the way we live. And we may think that that's the only way to live. This is one of the issues I have, that, you know, when sometimes I get into discussion, for example, many years ago, when I left teaching in a school, which was part of my work as a religious priest, I was teaching in a boys' school. When I left that activity after 6 years, I began a campaign to revolutionize it. And that meant that I would hold public protests out on the street in Dublin every exam time, once a year and so on. And people would come up to me and engage with me and say, but sure, what's the alternative? That was such a constant question that used to really frustrate me, that people couldn't see any alternative to the education system we had. Whereas my answer was, there is an infinite number of alternatives. This is just one. And we need to look carefully at what we have institutionalized within its structures, because that is really what I got to be aware of through being a teacher myself. I went in all, you know, starry-eyed and bushy-tailed to be a professional teacher, thinking that I could change the system from inside. And gradually I began to become aware of just how insidious it was and how fixed it was and how none of us within the system, none of us, were able to change it. And you can actually see that as an example. You can see that in the present Pope, Pope Francis, within the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. how it's quite clear he would love to change an awful lot more within the Catholic Church than he's able to.
Yeah.
He's been resisted and held back at every turn. And so education was the same. And like, the more I looked at it, I was kept asking myself, as part of a religious order who were involved in education in order to give a Christian formation to boys and to children. And I interpreted Christian formation as meaning that they would, that we would express the values of that Jesus preached and practiced. So one of those values would be inclusivity, giving everybody respect, and looking out particularly for the weak and the poor. And yet the school we were running had a hierarchical system where if you were good at your exams, you were put into the A class. If you're a medium in your exams, you got the B class. And if you found it hard to pass any exam, you got the C stream. You were in the C stream. So these kids in the C stream were like the waste, you know, the people that wouldn't benefit from schooling. But they were, it was all their fault, if you like, was the implication. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, if you see how some of those kids did after they left school, some of them had amazing lives, which school didn't recognise at all.
Yeah.
It's a bit like, I heard recently that two of the Beatles, Paul McCartney and George Harrison, went to the same school in Liverpool mm-hmm. when they were growing up. And both of them were in a music class. And they both said, A, they didn't enjoy it. And B, their talent was never noticed or recognised, mm-hmm. you know. So that's what I'm saying, like that. It's not the kids in school that are the problem. It's the system that is not catering to the individuality of every child. And how could it? If it was institutionalized as a structure, you know, I don't think it can. So that's where I'm coming from. Hmm.
I definitely hear you on that, the frustration with the what's the alternative. And I mean I think it's a good question to ask if you're sincere about finding alternatives, but it's frustrating in the sense of how could things be different? Like there's such a lack of imagination for, I see that a lot in, the pushback for critiques of, you know, global capitalism, like, well, what else could we do? This is the perfect system, right? And it's like it's just a way. Like, and there are things it's done well, and there's a lot that it's doing poorly. And if you look at how it's going to be in the future, like necessarily the way that it functions, it's not going to be good, especially for the Earth. And why don't we try to imagine a different way of being? And there's so much.
We can't keep growing the way we are.
No. Do you have any consistent practices or habits that are helpful for you?
Well, I come out of my background as a Catholic priest and as a religious with the practice of reading the office, which is morning prayer, midday prayer, evening prayer, and you read it all out of a book, which puts together various psalms and gospel readings and Bible readings and so on, prayers, intercessions. So that's my background, and included in that is singing and maybe sitting cross-legged on the floor on a cushion, lighting a candle. That's my background, but over the course of the years, all of that has faded away. Don't do it anymore. And now what I do as a spiritual practice is I get out, I go for a walk, I bring my binoculars with me, and I engage in nature. And that's really what appeals to me most, is being alone and being out in nature. And I get it too from gardening, from growing our own vegetables. My wife grows the flowers. All of that, having that life and growth around me as well. That's all part of it. And eating our own food, you know, that's all part of it. It's a lifestyle, really. It's a lifestyle choice. It's not just some particular practices during the day. Mm-hmm. It's the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's the whole way of life.
And you've been involved in an effort to make the island sustainable and carbon neutral. How's that been going?
Yeah, that's all my life. I've had a sort of one of my interests has been community development. And it's since I came to live here, I've been involved in the local community at that level. And thankfully, this community here are very proactive. So when we see an issue that needs to be dealt with, we don't act like victims who go crying to the government to solve our problems. We form a sort of an action group. And if it requires lobbying to the government, we will do that. Or if we can do it ourselves, we will do that. So I think there's a sense of pride among the local people here that we used to be self-sufficient in lots of different ways. Like, we're famous for our Aran Island sweaters. So we knitted our own jumpers and sweaters, but actually we made all our own clothes. We did weaving as well with other parts of our clothing and blankets and other things. We built our own homes out here with the local stone. We grew the thatch and that became the roofing material. We produced all our own food. We made our own boats to go out onto the water. So we were hugely self-sufficient, and like the Aran Islanders are very proud of that history. So within the course of this community development work, and people were saying we need to go back to that, where we become so dependent on the mainland for so many different goods and services now. Let's try and become self-sufficient again. So we formed a committee, and it ended up becoming a cooperative. So it's now a community-owned cooperative. It has over 100 shareholders out of the three islands together here, not just one. But there's only 1,200 people between the three islands, so it's not a huge population. And our aims and objectives are very clear. It's to become self-sufficient in clean energy, but also to make our own homes energy efficient so that they become more comfortable and use less energy. And then the energy that we do use in our homes, we want it to be clean energy that we've hopefully generated ourselves. So we're somewhat there. We want our transport to become clean as well. So a lot of us have electric cars now. I have a house here which doesn't use any fossil fuels. And we have heat pumps to heat our hot water and heat our radiators. We have solar photovoltaic panels generating electricity from the sun. We have an electric car here. And that's the way all three of the islands are going. And this cooperative, and I'm the chairperson of the cooperative, have been since it was founded in 2012. So it's sort of part of this stage of my life's work. It's something I decided I wanted to do, and I've given it my heart and soul. I was on national radio this morning talking about the budget that the government has just, you know, every government announces a budget once every year. And this is the first budget of the Irish government to begin tackling seriously the climate change emergency. So There's a big increase in carbon tax in our budget this year. There's a whole new emphasis on walking and cycling instead of driving a car. And there's new taxes put on fossil fuels and incentives for people to buy electric cars and so on. So they had me on the radio this morning giving my views on that.
That's great. Do you do a bunch of wind power out there? I would imagine that would work well there, or no?
Yep. We don't have a wind turbine yet. It's something we've been working towards since we were founded as a cooperative in 2012. But there are huge challenges to it. Even if we got full cooperation from all the community locally, and like the rest of the country, there are people for and people against wind turbines. Mm. So we can't guarantee that even. But also, our landscape here is very beautiful. Mm. And it's a huge asset in terms of tourism. So it'll be very difficult to get planning permission for a wind turbine.
Yeah.
And I suppose thirdly, we want the wind turbine that we do put up here to be community owned. And a turbine is estimated to cost about €1.5 million per megawatt. And we hope to put up a 2 or 2 megawatt or 3 megawatt. That's an awful lot of money for a local community to raise, you know. So there are huge challenges in doing it, but we hope to achieve it. Hmm.
I wanted to let you tell people where they could find out what's going on with you. And people can go to daramalloy.com.
Correct.
Check out what you're doing there. Anywhere else they should be following you or seeing what's going on with you?
Well, I'm on all the different social media, so they could find me on Instagram, I'd say, by just sticking in Dara Malloy, or on Facebook. I'm on all the different media. And I have a particular Facebook channel, which is called, I think, Dara Malloy Spirituality, Celtic Spirituality, something like that, which sort of just focuses on that spiritual thing, which I was talking about with you today. My wife, too, Tess Harper, has just published a book on Jungian psychology. Mm. That's called Young at Heart, Tools for Psychological Hygiene. People might be interested in that too. And they could get that probably through my website, daramalloy.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. It was lovely to speak with you.
Thanks very much, Dustin. It was very nice talking to you too. I enjoyed it.
If you have a moment today, it would help a ton if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and share this episode with a friend. Be sure to follow the podcast on Twitter and Instagram at CarryTheFirePod.
I want to thank my producer, Andy Lara, and all of our executive producers,
Chris Reeves, Tony Panaro, Sam George, Reed Duchess, Thomas Fortcourt, Shamir Hassan, Amy Armstrong, Luis Rivera, Gabe Munoz, Cameron Lane, Hamza Bebehana, Michael Maitland, Adam Collins, Susanna Coleman, Ian Hunt, John Diego, Jess Card, Mark Weiss, Brianna Webb, John Buchan, Denise Sugita, Colin Hawthorne, Brian Weisbecker, Josh Malara, Eric Gonzalez, Matthew Alcon, and Tiffany Payne. Thank you all so much for carrying the fire with me, and I'll see you next time.